Chapter 19. The key they had purchased so dearly from the construct gave very little away, other than its unusual colour. It was big. The shaft was as long as Gideon's middle finger, and the clover head satisfactorily heavy to hold, but it had no helpful tag saying, e.g., first floor. This did not seem to give Harrowhark pause. She whipped out her stained journal and brooded over her maps, hiding in a dark alcove and making her cavalier keep watch. Considering that there were exactly zero people around, this seemed stupid. Then again, the idea that there might not be zero people around, that there was something horrible infesting Canaan House, something that had killed Abigail and Magnus for a perceived slight. Well, Gideon did not stand there as easily as she might have yesterday. The first house was no longer a beautiful and empty shell, buffeted by the erosion of time. Now it seemed more like the blocked-up labyrinths beneath the ninth house, kept sealed in case something became restless. When she was young, she used to have nightmares about being on the wrong side of the door of the locked tomb, especially after what Harrow had done. "Look," said Harrowhark. No murder, sorrow, or fear could ever touch Harrow Nona Jesimus. Her tired eyes were alight. A lot of her paint had peeled away or been sweated off down in the facility, and the whole left side of her jaw was just grey-tinted skin. A hint of her humanity peeked through. She had such a peculiarly pointed little face, high-browed and tippy everywhere, and a slanted and vicious mouth. She said irascibly, "At the key, moron, not at me." The moron looked at the key, but did give her the middle finger. Hera was holding the thing upside down for inspection. At the butt end, where the teeth terminated, a tiny carving had been made in the metal. It was a collection of dots joined together with a line and two half circles. "It's the sign on my door," said Gideon.
"You mean X203?
"Yeah, I mean that, if you're talking in moonspeak," said Gideon. "It's definitely the symbol on my door." Hera nearly trembled with eagerness. It took them a while to sneak down the curling route from the atrium to the corridor to the foyer leading to the pit. She was paranoid, and her paranoia had infected Gideon. They kept waiting before turning corners, and then stopping to hear if they were being followed. By the time they reached the airless little vestibule and had slipped the tapestry aside from the doorframe and ducked through, Gideon's stomach wanted breakfast. Nonetheless, her palms were slick with anticipation as they stood in front of the enormous black door. The animal skulls were as eerie and unwelcoming as they had been the first time, the writhing fat figure curled around each column as creepy and as cold. Harrowhark set her hands on the black stone crossbar of the door almost reverently and pressed her ear to the rock as though she could hear what was going on inside. She stroked her thumb pad over the deep-set keyhole and pulled her hood over her head.
"Unlock it," she said.
"Don't you want the honours?"
"It's your keyring," said Harrow unexpectedly, "and we will do this by the book. If teacher's correct, there is something around here that is fairly hot on etiquette, and etiquette is cheap. The keyring is yours, I have to admit it, so you must admit us."
She held out the key to Gideon.
"Put it in the hole, Griddle."
"That's what she said," said Gideon, and she took the ring from Harrow's gloved fingers. She did not put her own hood up, but she slipped her glasses back onto her nose. Now that she'd adjusted, she really only needed them for the midday light, but they'd become something of a comfort. She drummed her fingers on the beveled frame of lightless stone, and then she slid the red response key into the lock. It fit. The lock clicked open as easily as if it had been kept oiled for the last 10,000 years. Without the slightest creak or groan of hinge, the door swung inward at a push. Gideon slipped her rapier from her belt and her knuckle knives onto her left hand, and she walked into the darkness. It was dark. She did not dare go farther into the quiet and shadowy stillness, thrown into deeper quiet by her necromancer slipping in behind and pushing the massive door shut. They stood in the room and smelled the age of it. The dust, the chemicals hanging in the air. You could almost smell the darkness. Harrow's voice, almost a whisper.
A light, Nev.
What?
You did bring a torch.
This is a service I was unaware I was meant to provide, said Gideon. There followed soft cursing. She felt Harrow turn back toward the door, measure its width with her hands, grope blindly along the doorframe in order to find a lantern. She found something, and from the wall there came a loud click. Electric lights blared to life overhead, throwing the dark and lonely room into nice sharp relief. Gideon didn't know what she'd expected. She stood rooted to the ground, and so did Harrow. And for long moments, they just got their fill of looking. It was a study, left crystallized by someone who had one day stood up and never come back to the place where they must have worked for years. It was a long, square, spacious apartment, windowless, but beautifully lit. A long rail of electric lamps threw spotlights on important points in the room's geography. One end of the room was occupied by a laboratory. Stained, scoured laminate benches and shelves of notes in leather-bound books or ring binders. The big metal sink and the scrubbing up brush looked strange against the walls, which were inlaid with bones. A pot was still full of fat chalk sticks to draw diagrams, and the flasks of preserved blood were still full and very red. Tacked up over one bench were thick sheaves of flimsy, dark with graphs and models. One of the flimsies was a rough drawing of a familiar chimera, many-armed, armor-ribbed, squat-skulled. There were jeweled tools. There were epoxy spatulas that had been melted in some experiment. There was a blown-up picture on the wall, a lithograph or a polymer photograph of a group of people clustered around a table. Their faces had all been scribbled out with a thick black marker pen. Harrow Hark had already drifted to the laboratory. She hadn't drawn breath yet. She was going to have to, Gideon thought distantly, or she'd be out on the floor. The room had been split into three main parts. There was the laboratory, and then a broad space where the furniture had been moved out of the way for an empty stone floor. The wall had a sword rack, and the sword rack still held two lonely rapiers, gleaming as though they'd been filed and whetted an hour before. A training floor. Lent up against the wall was a hideous collection of oblong metal shapes and stocks. It took Gideon a long time to realise that she was looking at something goddamn ancient. It was a blowback carbine gun. She'd only ever seen pictures. The third part of the room was a raised platform with polished wooden stairs. The wood here was not so degraded as in the rest of Canaan House. This lightless, shut-off room must have preserved it, or otherwise somehow been stopped in time. The hairs on the back of Gideon's neck had risen when the lights came on, and they hadn't gone back down, as if her intrusion might well tempt time back to claim its grave goods. She found herself climbing the stairs and staring at a sweetly banal and domestic sight. A bookcase, a low table, a squashy armchair and two beds. On the table was a teapot and two cups that lay abandoned forever. The two beds were close to each other. If you lay in one, you could stretch out and touch whoever was sleeping in the other, provided you had a long arm, separated only by a nightstand. Much like the grotesque cradle tacked to the end of the enormous four-poster back in Hera's bedroom, the two people here would have been in proximity to wake if the other one sneezed. On the nightstand was another lamp and debris that people had never cleared up. A very old watch, an empty glass, a filament-fine silver bracelet with no clasp, a shallow, greasy glass dish full of grey stuff like ashes. Gideon could tell they weren't cremains, and when she touched them, a strong scent clung to her fingers. The pillows had been smoothed out on the carved wooden cots, and the beds had been made. Someone had left a pair of extremely worn slippers beneath one, a crumpled piece of flimsy next to the nightstand. Gideon picked up the latter. Harrow let out a cry of triumph. Gideon turned away from the beds and put the flimsy in her pocket, then stretched over the stair railing to see what her necromancer was delighted about. She was by the workbench, staring at two great stone tablets that had been fused to the stone, shot through with pale green filaments glowing beneath Harrow's touch. The writing was small and cramped, and the diagrams totally impenetrable in their obtuseness. Harrow was already pulling out her journal.
"It's the theorem from the trial room," she called out. "It's the completed methodology for transference, for the utilization of a living soul. It's the whole experiment."
"Is this an exciting necromancer thing?"
"Yes, Nav, it is an exciting necromancer thing. I need to copy this down. I can't lift the stone. Whoever did this was a genius."
Gideon let Harrow have at it and opened the first drawer of the nightstand. Sitting there, offensively ordinary, were three pencils, a finger bone, a coarse sharpening stone. Bones and whetstones were beginning to feed her growing suspicion about who'd lived there, and an old, worn-down seal. She stared at the seal a while. It was the crimson and white emblem of the second house. She sat down carefully on one of the beds, and the sprung mattress squeaked. She took the piece of crumpled-up flimsy out of her pocket and began trying to uncrumple it. It was part of a note that had, at some long-ago point, been ripped up, and this was just one scrunched corner.
"I'm done," said Harrow from below. "Tell me anything of import."
Gideon stuffed the piece of flimsy back into her pocket and had a quick scan through the other drawers. A lost sock, a scalpel, oilcloth, a tin with nothing in it but the vague waft of peppermints. This was all the stuff you'd find in anyone's bedside drawers, though, then again, not quite anyone's, a particular pair of people. She descended the stairs and tipped her dark glasses high on her head.
"A Cav and their necro lived here," she said.
"I drew the same conclusion," said Harrow Hark, shuffling her papers.
She put one of her diagrams close to the one inscribed on the stone tablet to compare them for accuracy.
"Here, come and take a look at this."
Harrow's cramped handwriting was just as bad as the etching on the tablet. At the very end of a long list of exquisitely boring notes was a line on its own. "In the hope of attaining literal understanding, all glory and love to the Necrolord Prime." The ninth necromancer said,
"Now there's a helpful postscript if ever I saw one."
"Yeah, and the fact that there are two beds upstairs and a bunch of swords also help," said Gideon. "They were living in each other's pockets. They studied weird literal theorems. There's a seriously old second house sign in one of the top drawers."
They both took the time to roam around the room. Harrow flipped through notebooks and narrowed her eyes over the contents. Gideon picked up another book and squinted at the faded message on the flyleaf, written in black ink forever ago and frozen in time. "One flesh, one end, G and P." They combed over the detritus of two strangers' lives. Inside a forgotten tin, Gideon found two expired toothbrushes. They were electronic ones with revolving heads and push buttons. "These aren't just seriously old. They're super unbelievably seriously old," she said.
"Yes," said Harrow. "Sextus could tell us how old, but I've no desire to ask him. Something has been done to preserve this room. It is not wasted away into a natural death. We're probably the first people to step inside since its previous occupants left."
It didn't seem to be a proper bedroom. More like a place to stay overnight while doing something else. More lab than living space. Gideon ended up staring at the photolithograph, elbows pressed into the countertop, studying faceless bodies gathered primly in their chairs. A rainbow of arms and robes, low-resolution hands clasping low-resolution knees. The hands without faces seemed solemnly posed, almost anxious.
"All I know," said Hero Hark eventually, "is that they created the theorem and were responsible for the experiment downstairs. I wish I knew more. I yearn to know more. But I don't. I'm going to study this spell, Griddle, and learn it, and then I will be one step closer to knowing. We cannot suffer the same fate as Quinn and Pent."
Gideon was amazed at how badly it hurt all of a sudden. "He's really dead," she said aloud.
"Yes. I will be more upset if he suddenly changes condition," said Hero. "He was a stranger, Nav. Why does it affect you so much?"
"He was nice to me," she found herself saying. She was very tired. She tried to wake herself up by stretching, dropping down to touch her toes and feeling the blood rush into her head. "Because he was a stranger, I think. He didn't have to bother with me, to make time for me or remember my name. But he did. Hell, you treat me more like a stranger than Magnus Quinn did, and I've known you all my life. Anyway, I don't want to talk about it."
Hera's hand, peeled and naked without a glove and stained with ink all the way up to her cuticles, appeared in front of her. Gideon found her shoulder drawn back so that she had to look Hera square in the face. The necromancer regarded her with a strangely fierce eye, mouth a worn-down line of indecision, forehead puckered as though she was thinking her entire face into a wrinkle. There was still blood flaking out of her eyebrows, which was gross.
"I must no longer accept," she said slowly, "being a stranger to you."
"Whoa, whoa, whoa," said Gideon, sudden sweat prickling the back of her neck. "Yes, you can. You once told me to dig myself an ice grave. Stop before this gets weird."
"Quinn's death proves that this is not a game," said Harrow, moistening her ashy lips with her tongue. "The trials are meant to winnow out the wheat from the chaff, and it is going to be exceptionally dangerous. We are all the sons and daughters that the House of the Ninth possesses, Nav."
"I'm not anybody's son or daughter," said Gideon firmly, now in no small panic.
"I need you to trust me."
"I need you to be trustworthy."
In the thick dimness of the room, she watched the black-garbed girl in front of her struggle around a thing that had settled over them like a net, a thing that had fused between them like a badly broken limb, shattered numerous times, healing, gnarled and awful. Gideon recognised these strictures all of a sudden, the rope tying her to Harrow and back to the bars of the House of the Ninth. They stared at each other with shared panic.
Harrow said finally,
"In what way can I earn your trust?"
"Let us sleep for 8 bloody hours and never talk like this again," said Gideon,
and her necromancer relaxed very minutely. Her eyes were so lightlessly black that it was hard to see the pupil. Her mouth was thin and waspish and unsure. She remembered when Harrow was 9, when she had walked in at just the wrong moment. She remembered that 9-year-old Harrow's mouth falling slightly slack. There was something curious about Harrow's face when it was not fixed into the bland church mask of the reverend daughter. Something thin and desperate and quite young about it. Something not totally removed from Jean-Marie's desperation.
8.5, Harrow said, "if we start again immediately in the morning."
"Done.
Done."
Several hours later, Gideon turned over in her bed, chilled by the realization that Harrow had not promised to never talk like that again. Too much of this shit and they'd end up friends. As they walked back, the halls were as lonely as they ever had been, emptier somehow,
as though, with the fifth's untimely end, Canaan House had managed to expunge what little self it had. There was only one exception. A quiet pattering of steps drew both of them pressed flat into an alcove, staring out at the thin grey pre-morning light. On very nearly silent feet, the fourth teens passed before them, rapidly crossing an empty and dilapidated hall on some mission. Jean-Marie led with her rapier drawn, and her necromancer stumbled behind, head bent, blue hood over his hair, looking like a penitent. Another second and they were gone. Gideon found herself thinking, poor little buggers. In her nest of blankets, the light coming in yellow and unwelcome from the cracks around the curtains, Gideon was too tired to take off her clothes and almost too tired to sleep. She kept rustling when she turned over, trying to find a comfortable spot. And then she remembered the crinkled note in her pocket. In the dim light, she smoothed it open and stared at it, blearily, pillows still sticky with bits of the cold cream she used to take off her paint. But we all know the sad and trying reality is that this will remain incomplete t- the last. He can't fix my deficiencies. Please give Gideon my congratulations, however.